AI is transforming higher education and the way our students approach their learning at lightning speed.
You should be excited about AI in education because the impact is much more exciting than the tech.
For students doing their homework using AI tools like ChatGPT, Google Gemini, or an image generator like DALL-E, that's cheating, right? Or is it?
So the burden on the educator is change the assignments. Allow them, in fact, require that they use these systems so that they can do things that they wouldn't ordinarily be able to do.
A study sponsored by Turnitin shows 75% of the students surveyed would continue using AI even if the school banned the technology. As artificial intelligence evolves, school officials and faculty members are creating new guidelines and curriculums to adapt.
A student could get through an entire class without doing any original work.
AI. It's here, it's now, but did anyone actually ask for it? And how will it affect how we teach and how we learn?
Hello, and welcome back to The Secret Life of Language, a podcast from the School of Languages and Linguistics at the University of Melbourne. I'm Professor John Hajek.
And I'm Dr. Yu Hao. Thanks for joining us for this third in a series of episodes in which we look at how generative AI is impacting teaching and research activities in university settings.
Earlier in this series, we looked at some of the broader ethical and policy challenges for universities in their adoption of, well, some actually might say collision with, generative artificial intelligence. In this episode, we wanted to steer the focus to how Gen AI is impacting students' learning and the ways we measure that learning through assessment.
These days, when students are handing you completed essays as part of their assessment, how do you know they wrote them by themselves? Perhaps they've turned to generative AI products like Claude or Gemini or ChatGPT or one of the many other options for help.
Maybe they've used the technology to simply check and correct their grammar, or to get beyond an initial writer's block and jumpstart their work, or to translate a piece they've written in their own language, or, you knew this was coming, to research and write the whole thing in the time it takes to key in a prompt.
And it's not just written assessments that can quickly and often quite convincingly be generated by AI. So making presentations, visualizing data, creating graphics or audio or video, generative AI can do the heavy lifting for these tasks as well.
And if the purpose of assessment tasks is to gauge student learning, and remember, that's what we're here for, student learning, then in the age of generative AI, where does that leave us and what needs to change?
So in this episode, we try to get some answers to these questions from our two guests, Professor Raoul Mulder of the University of Melbourne and Dr. Julian Harris, who's just moved from the University of Melbourne to La Trobe University. Raoul, welcome to the program. So can you tell us a little about yourself and your interest in this topic of AI and learning?
So I am a scientist by training. My discipline area of research is in animal behavior. I study birds. And for the past 20 years or so, I've been a teacher and a researcher at the University of Melbourne in School of Biosciences. But I've also always had a very, very deep and strong interest in student learning and anything that has to do with university education. And so I now also have a half-time role as a professor of higher education in the Centre for the Study of Higher Education at the University of Melbourne, where I have more of a policy role. So my interest in AI comes from being in the trenches, experiencing as a teacher what sort of challenges are coming up around generative AI use by the students that I'm teaching, but then also thinking about that from a policy perspective at an institutional level about what kind of advice should we be giving staff and students and what do we need to be doing as an institution to manage the opportunities and the challenges around generative AI.
And Julian, what about you?
Well, I'm sort of literally sitting in the middle. On the one hand, my PhD research area was applied linguistics in School of Languages and Linguistics, particularly interested in sociolinguistics. More recently, I've been working with RAL in the Center for the Study of Higher Education in the area of as a teaching and learning specialist and in the area of academic development.
So, Raoul, what challenges has generative AI brought to the university setting, in your honest opinion?
Look, the obvious and immediate challenge for universities sits around assessment. So as universities, we're in the business of warranting some kind of learning that's happened. We issue our students with degrees, and those degrees tell future employers, people in the community, something about what we think that student has achieved or has learned. The way we measure that is through assessments. And in the university ecosystem, the traditional way in which we assess work is by getting students to produce an artifact of some kind. So that can be an essay or a report that's assessed and it's graded. And from that grade and that assessment, we infer something about what kind of learning has happened. Because most of the traditional university documents are written, the fact that we now have these platforms that can very easily generate high-quality text outputs that look very much like work produced by a student means that we have a dilemma. If a student can generate an artifact using a generative AI platform that looks very much like an artifact that a student sweating, trying to learn has generated, then we can't be sure whether the student has learned anything. And so now we have a dilemma. If we release graduates to the outside world that have generated most of their work using Gen AI platforms rather than through actually learning something, that is really troubling. How do we know that they are going to be safe and competent professionals?
And RAL there is largely talking about the summative assessment types. And if we look at processes, we've also got to consider formative assessment. And so if the extent to which students are learning from doing, getting feedback on what they've done and are able to apply that feedback to further iterations of an assessment task. So if they're generating the content for these through ChatGPT and they're doing it unthinkingly without deliberation, then there's a failure in learning that's going to go on as well in that formative sense.
Well, how come some of our colleagues are teaching their students how to use AI for assessment purposes? Why are they doing this if we can't work out whether they've actually learned anything?
So I think the key is to use AI in a considered way. And so the challenge for us is to work out what is a meaningful, useful way to employ AI in the generation of some kind of product, some kind of learning process, and what is a not very meaningful way. Obviously, plugging a prompt into a generative AI platform, getting it to spit out a response and submitting that is meaningless, right? No learning has happened. But there are ways in which AI can be used in a constructive way, I think. So students sometimes use it for brainstorming, or students might use it as an effective summary tool. There are a range of different ways. And I think if we can help students learn how to use AI ethically and effectively around their learning, then there's absolutely no reason why they shouldn't be using it. The challenge is working out how to do that well. I don't think we want to have a sort of a Wild West approach where it's just a free-for-all and students use it in whatever way they want to. I think the onus is on us to help them with that, because the reality is it's very hard to imagine a future that isn't going to be infused with generative AI platforms.
Oh, no, look, I agree with that. Although it's interesting to talk to students, I think not all of them are so enamored of using AI, actually don't find it that interesting. You know, I had a group of students and I asked them, only one of them admitted to using it. The other four, I was quite surprised. It wasn't that they didn't want to own up to using it, they just didn't find it interesting. So that was a bit of a surprise. But I'm sure that's not typical, because of course we know that universities around the country have been hit by waves of students submitting AI-generated work, you know, and academic integrity panels are overloaded. They can't deal with the rush. I just can't understand, you know, what techniques there are to ensure that it's not AI doing the work, that they're doing the work. I keep hearing these things, we have to teach them how to do it, but no one ever gives me examples.
I can give you an example then. So I designed and implemented an alternative for a fully online subject, 700 plus students, 10% of whom took this option of doing a contemporary research report. A part of that 2,000-word task was broken down And this is in no way Gen AI proof, but nevertheless broken down into three smaller reflective pieces that were handed in or submitted across the semester. And each of those reflective pieces involved the students initially being trained up on a particular prompt engineering framework and having a baseline measure of them first using Gen AI without any training. And I can imagine in some ways your students were bored by the tech because they hadn't really been trained or taught in any way how to use it effectively and interestingly. So they reflected on the difference between learning this technique, prompt engineering, so allocating Gen AI a particular role, defining the parameters and making it clear what you wanted and then iterating on that versus kind of, for many of them, using it as they might Google. The next small piece that they reflected on was I put them in small groups and we included generative AI, in most cases ChatGPT, and asked them how to compare working with a peer and working with Gen AI, the strengths, limitations of that.
But it's quite easy for me to ask ChatGPT to write me 400 words about my experience of working with somebody else on a project of AI and write it quite well, fully grammatical, no errors in English. You could post-edit that if you wish. I mean, I actually don't see how these tasks, I mean, I'm ready to be convinced, but I'm not convinced that these tasks are foolproof and can't simply be used with ChatGPT or whatever system you want to use. By the way, as an experiment, I recently used ChatGPT 4.0 to compose a piece on a topic I know very well, and one which, in fact, I'm one of the most cited experts on. In other words, I should have been cited as one of the sources in the piece it pumped out. And I should say I went to great pains to prompt carefully to get what I wanted. But the result was that it didn't mention me at all. In fact, it knew nothing about my work, knew nothing about anything that I'd written previously, which I thought was pretty amazing. Now, I bring all this up because one way for students to show you that they've actually done their research in a specific area is to refer to the acknowledged experts in that area when it comes to writing up their essays or other assessment tasks. So my point here is that making students aware of this problem is perhaps one way of getting them not to rely on generative AI so much. Otherwise, they're not going to realise that the references that are generated may have nothing to do with the topic at hand.
Is this the time I should point out that John is our in-house skeptic?
Oh, I'm not necessarily a skeptic. I just am not convinced that these things about assessment are actually teaching them knowledge. They may be teaching them how to use ChatGPT, but they're not teaching them knowledge. And the reason I was surprised it did such a bad job was because I didn't realise that a lot of the publications are behind a paywall. And there's your trick. If you want to make sure that you really want to test people's knowledge, use topics that where a lot of the current information is behind a paywall.
Look, the challenge at the moment is we simply have no idea what data the models are trained on. So there will undoubtedly be some information that is behind paywalls. I imagine that these large companies are going to negotiate with publishers and others to make sure that even stuff that is currently behind a paywall will be accessible.
The publishers are rubbing their hands as we speak.
Yeah, and I think from a scientific perspective, from a research perspective, the big problem is that we don't know where all this has been pulled from. We don't know how authoritative the source is. Now, when we look at references in the literature, we know that they are peer-reviewed. We know they've been sent through some quality process. We can follow the references. I've had a very interesting experience where some of my students wrote a research paper on my topic area, animal behavior. And I knew that they had generated the reference list from ChatGPT because the reference list included three papers, apparently by me, in journals that I might have published in, with titles that look like the titles that I might have published, but they were not papers that I'd ever written.
But in this case, you'd imagine that its data set did not include 2 years ago, a lot of paywall academic research. Now it does.
Yeah, it's clearly getting better. It's hallucinating less, and the information it's providing, references, for example, is verifiable. So it'll provide a digital object identifier for the reference. You click on it, clearly a paper, you can find it. What I lie awake about at night is what gets lost. Assuming that the generative AI genie is out of the bottle and that we can't really restrict anyone from using it, what gets lost when students are using generative AI from the get-go? Now, some of the surveys that have been done of students that ask them about what they're using it for hear from students that they're using it to speed up the process. That assessment would have taken me 10 hours of research, and I did it in two. Amazing. What gets lost when that gets speeded up? How do students develop those evaluative judgment skills that John's able to apply to say these references are, not the key ones in this field? I think you make a great point about whether or not the idea of AI-proof assessment is a pipe dream. And I think the truth is, it is. AI is already capable of an incredible amount, and this is just a galloping field in terms of development. So I think the chances that institutions of higher education will catch up or get ahead of that AI development curve are diminishingly small. When ChatGPT first came out, it was very much a text-based type of interface that people were interacting with. And so the idea was, we'll just create assessments that don't involve written outputs. Let's get students to produce videos, or let's get students to give oral presentations. Well, now there are generative AI platforms that will happily generate a PowerPoint presentation based on some inputs. There are incredibly sophisticated video generation platforms. It seems inconceivable that there is going to be something that a generative AI platform can't do in the future.
Oh, no, I have a very good answer to that. We go back to the traditional way of assessment in countries around the world, such as in Italy, where I studied, where most of your assessment is done by direct oral assessment. So you have no PowerPoints to show. You sit in front of a panel of three examiners and you are asked questions that you respond to directly in front of an audience of 200, 300 students. That's the only way to assure that people aren't using AI to directly provide the answer.
Well, only if we decide that that's the only solution for every assessment and that every assessment has to be secure. I think a more realistic way of approaching that is to say, and we're thinking very much about assessments now just as assessments with a summative purpose that are about grading, that are about evaluating, that are about ranking students. And it's worth stepping back to this question of what is assessment for? Partly it's for that purpose. We want to be able to evaluate students. We want to be able to say something about how this student compares to this student in terms of achievement, in terms of knowledge, etc. But assessment also has an incredibly important role in terms of signaling to students so what matters and motivating students to learn. And a lot of that is a sort of assessment for learning, assessment that involves iterative cycles where students present a draft and get feedback on it and then get to improve it again. We know that learning is a cyclical process. And so I think we need to really think about that balance. How much of that assessment is going to be formative for learning and how much of it is going to be summative assessment of learning? Because, to give my institution as an example, we have 11,000 assessments here. There is just no way on earth that we are going to be able to do oral vivas for every one of those, nor would it make sense.
Oh, I'm not suggesting that we do. I'm just giving you a foolproof way of doing it. Of course, the other way of doing it is having handwritten assessment in a non-IT environment. I mean, that's the only other way. And then, of course, we can't read handwriting because they don't know how to handwrite anymore.
One of the things that I hear a lot when people talk about the threat of generative AI to assessment security is we all need to revert back to invigilated examinations, bring the students into a hallway, sit them down, look over their shoulder, give them a time-limited period in which they answer a set of questions. I think that's a terrible way to try and address this because over the years we've learned that those types of assessments may offer you increased security, but they're terrible from so many perspectives in terms of the other things that we want from assessment. We want it to be valid. We want it to be fair and equitable. We don't want it to disadvantage particular groups.
Hold on. We want it to be valid. We want it to be equitable. How can we say that assessment is valid if it's been done with AI and equitable, if someone knows how to use AI better than other people?
Well, in your case, there are certain people who might perform better than others in front of an audience when defending their thesis, let's say. So like the large-scale exams that are being spoken about, sometimes these traditional techniques assess little more than a person's ability to perform in those environments, perhaps. So, yes, you're right. I mean, but there's always been, whether it's contract cheating, notes on the arms, there's always been that concern about academic integrity. Sorry, the one thing I'd suggest is if you are open about the desire for academic integrity as well as digital literacy with students and make it clear the value, for example, of them undertaking the tasks as effectively and ethically as they can, then there'll be a significant number who will see the value in doing that.
Can I? I mean, I'm not that I'm making the claim that we should all be doing 100% assessment in those conditions, not at all. But some inclusion of those kinds of assessment does provide you with a baseline of the actual, you know, what the knowledge level might be of a student. Everything is performative. Even preparing an essay and handing it over is performative. The problem is AI does such a good performative job on a written piece of text. So what one person has told me that they're now doing is, because of course lots of students say, oh, I had multiple iterations of this draft, you know, I did multiple drafts and then I put it through ChatGPT just or some AI platform just to tidy it up. The problem is they can't revert back. They can't show earlier versions because, of course, they don't save them. They never do. The only way to do that automatically is you have to set up a OneDrive folder and you need to save your work there because it is entirely reversible there. So you can see whether they have actually gone through and, you know, rewritten the text, you know, you might say notionally by computer hand in the way that they claim they have rather than, you know, putting in a prompt into ChatGPT.
Yeah, I think that's a great point because it kind of comes close to this question of when is the learning happening, right? That's really what we're trying to look at. And an audit trail is a story of how learning happened. There are actually some technological platforms. We use one of them at my university, which are about creating that environment and actually preserving that audit trail. So these platforms, students work within them. They're essentially a word processing environment. But the teacher can go in and they can see when was the assignment started, how many words were added, was a whole block of text pasted in, or how was it written?
So, do we have any data on the take-up of generative AI by students? Or is it all anecdotal at this stage?
No, there's some research done by Monash and Melbourne University academics. And over last year, so 2023, in semester one and then again in semester two, they surveyed a number of students and academic staff on their use of ChatGPT. And of course, in a sense, this is self-reporting, so like we have to consider that, but certainly in semester one, so this is when we think about it, when ChatGPT, we'd come back from the summer holidays and bang, it's there for us. And at that point, fewer than 50% of students indicated they were using ChatGPT. So, but, you know, towards the, I think it was conducted in May of 2023, that survey. By November 2023, 82% of students indicated they were using ChatGPT or Gen AI.
So you use the term indication, or is it really admission? In other words, there's a kind of dirty secret element to it. At least there was at that stage.
Yeah, the communications around how it might be used, if it might be used within our university and many others, were a little ambiguous and unclear. So there was a great deal of anxiety among students.
Well, you know, it depends on how we're trying to get information about this. So surveying students is clearly one way in which we can try and learn about that. If students are worried about it, then you have the same problems that you have when you're trying to survey students about contract cheating. They worry that somehow this will come back to them, and so they may not be entirely honest. There have been surveys conducted in a range of different places. We recently ran a summit. Some work at the University of Queensland suggests that about a third of students don't touch generative AI programs. About a third of the students are using it in a fairly superficial way, and another third are using it close to its full potential. There's other work that's been done in the UK that found that about half of students have used generative AI with their assessments. But that's also harvested some interesting additional information about what students do or don't know. And we might get onto the topic of AI literacy, so to speak, in a moment. But what they found in that study, that more than a third of the students don't know what some of the things are that they need to be aware of with generative AI platforms. They don't know that it sometimes makes up facts. They don't know that it sometimes hallucinates. What they also found in that study was that most students think that using Gen AI is acceptable if you're using it for explaining or suggesting or summarizing, but they realize that, you know, you shouldn't just be using it to generate work that you submit as is.
And should you label anything that you submit that has been used with generative AI as such?
That's one of the bedrocks of policy at our institution. So we don't ban the use of AI, either by students or by staff. But an absolute non-negotiable is that if you use generative AI in any part of your assessment generation, then you need to cite and acknowledge that and be clear about how you've used it.
Well, actually, I think a lot of staff are confused around what the policy is. It's not very clear to people, and it's clear that individuals are struggling with what they're supposed to be doing. And I think it's driven by a whole series of different factors. It'll depend also on the discipline, I think, and the sorts of areas that you might be working in. But I get the sense it's not very clear to staff, and they don't know necessarily where to look online for clear guidance.
I absolutely agree that, you know, building up staff and student literacy around AI is really important. Certainly, getting them up to speed to a certain level of AI literacy is a really high priority. So the grey area here is that it's impossible for a university or an institution to set a set of rules that will apply to everyone and will make sense for everyone. In terms of our university's policy around generative AI, students are not banned from using generative AI, but the onus is on subject coordinators to communicate really clearly with their students what is okay and what is not okay. And I think the grey area that we're in at the moment is that there are still a lot of educators that are a little bit like deer caught up in the headlights that haven't thought through what might they use it for and would I be okay with that and what do I tell them about that. So there's a little bit of non-communication happening in that space at the institutional level. Students are clear if they're going to use AI, they've got to cite it. They're not banned from using it. But the subtleties of would it be okay to use it to summarize a paper, would it be okay to use it for brainstorming, etc., that will vary from subject to subject, and currently the onus is on educators, the subject coordinators, to decide that and to communicate
that.
Well,
I think I would, you know, it's not just about content that I teach, but I also teach language, so I'd be very hesitant because they write perfect language. That's the thing, and that's one of the giveaways is you think these sorts of structures, this sort of vocabulary is not possible for this level of language learning. It's absolutely beyond what can reasonably be expected.
But again, when you think about the sophistication of emerging generative AI tools, there are now generative AI tools that students can plug that product into and say, make it sound like I'm a first-year student. Introduce some errors. Make some grammatical mistakes here or there. Well, that will make it seem less perfect.
Well, that's
able to be judged from that.
Well, that's absolutely true. So then it comes down to the fact that what we need to do is have an in-class test with pen and paper.
I think that what this brings up is a really critical issue around how assessments are perceived. Why do students try and cheat on assessments? You know, why wouldn't they do them? Because they see assessments as troublesome hurdles that they need to get over in order to get to this desired endpoint, which is a degree in their hand and a track to some kind of opportunity.
Whereas for me, you know, I'm thinking a formative assessment along the path. I'm saying, okay, let's do some assessment week 3. This will give me an idea of where you might be at.
Yep.
And then, you know, week 6, week 9, week 12, let's do some more assessment. Let me see what progress or not has been made.
So if we can succeed in shifting that mindset and having students think about assessments not as troublesome hurdles to overcome, but as helpful friends that are giving us useful suggestions about how we can improve at something that we care about, that we want to be better at, you know, the less we're likely to have that problem. And so I think part of the challenge around assessment design is around, well, how do we design assessments that are more likely to be completed with integrity, whether it be, you know, through use of AI or through contract cheating? And we know a little bit about that. We know that if we give students a bit of autonomy, if we allow them to choose, for example, the topic that they want to write about within a sort of a range, if we give them some freedom there, that makes the task more meaningful. If we're helping them to develop a competence or a skill that they see as being useful to their future, then they're less likely to cheat on it. If we're doing something that involves them being connected to their peers or to other students, they perceive the task as being more meaningful. There's a lot that we can do on the design front that is about creating assessments that seem really meaningful. And where a student might say, why would I cheat on that? I spent some time chatting with an educator a few years ago, and he had this brilliant analogy, which was around children. And he was saying, think about a three-year-old and the way a three-year-old is exploring the world. Can you imagine using the term cheating on your learning for a three-year-old? It just doesn't make sense. Pointless. Why would a three-year-old cheat on their learning? So it's kind of that mindset, I think, around, you know, a hunger for learning, a thirst for learning, and a perception of assessment as something helpful rather than a block or a barrier.
So what about the case of, say, a postgraduate student who's writing thesis chapters, but their native language is not English, and their English level is not really sophisticated enough for the task at hand? If they decided to use generative AI tools to translate, or at least boost the quality of their written English, is that okay? And let's assume the logic and ideas and arguments in their thesis chapters are all their own work. Is there a problem with that?
The policy, at this university at least, is that the work that you generate must be generated by you. So if a student were to write a brilliant chapter in a language other than English, and use a translator tool to translate that into English and submit that as an assessment, that would be considered a clear-cut case of academic misconduct.
So what if they wrote it, say, in English that is less than perfect, and then they just use it as a cleanup?
Again, I think that would be one of the grey areas where it would be up to the subject coordinator to make a call about it. But I think language is a really vexed area for this because you've got that sort of clear-cut case. Literal translation from one thing to another. That's not your own words.
But they wrote it.
Exactly. And we know that language can be, these tools can be immensely helpful.
But they wrote the text, so it is their text. I mean, that's the argument.
It's their text, but it's not their text in English, which is the language that we're using to assess here.
Well,
at
you
the
need
university.
To convince them because, you know, we get students say, but I wrote it.
Well, for example, I had a dilemma recently where a student completed an exam, short answer exam. All of the answers were in Chinese. I took the answers, I copied them into a translator tool, and they were coherent answers if I translated them into English. But, you know, I couldn't award marks for it because the policy is that students have to write in English.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't work for language programs. You're completely screwed in a second. I know that in the case of PhDs, you know, you can only write your PhD in a language other than English with authorization. You can't do it automatically.
You know, why have English language admission standards for the university? Why not just accept students that are, you know, that can't speak a word of English as students at the university because we know that they can use a translation tool to translate their ideas?
Now, Ral, you've swapped sides. You've joined the dark side with me, and now I'm defending your case. I don't quite understand this. Why is translation all of a sudden different from using AI for other purposes? I don't understand it.
No, I'm not saying it's different. I'm saying it's a really vexed area in terms of what current policy looks like.
Yep.
And current policy does not allow translation tools to translate a piece of written work into a completely different language that is considered to be academic misconduct. Now, is it possible that in 2-3 years' time, we'll realize that that's not a sustainable policy or that it's not an appropriate policy? I don't know. I'm just saying that that's a current pain point.
So not all AI is good AI.
If we move the focus from the students to the academic, or the lecturer or tutor, what can generative AI do for them? I'm thinking particularly in the area of marking. I mean, marking or grading papers is, for many, the bane of their existence. So what are the pros and cons there?
So I think there's enormous potential, is the short answer, for generative AI to be useful around assessment and feedback. To give you an example, we know that feedback is one of the issues that students most complain about in university systems. Every year, universities release student feedback about a range of different aspects of their experience. Feedback always rates lowly. Well, there are a few reasons for that. One is that we tend to give feedback at the very end of the process. So students will submit the final piece of work and we will give them a mark and justify the mark with some comments. We call that feedback, but it's not feedback the student can actually use in any meaningful way to improve. So how much learning is going on as part of that feedback, we don't know. The other issue is about the things that make feedback worthwhile and useful for students. So we know that, you know, feedback that is useful is timely, you get back quickly, usable, so you can do something with it, and specific. And we fall short on that. And the reason for that is scale. So if you're teaching first year undergraduate biology, there are 2,000 students in the subject. You have 2,000 pieces of assessment to mark. You're not going to get feedback back to students, depending on how well resourced the subject is, very quickly. Now, with a generative AI feedback model, students could get instant feedback. And it wouldn't matter whether there were 2,000 or 4,000 or 5,000. So there's a potential really significant leap to be made there, especially in that assessment for learning space, the formative space. I think it's also real potential in the summative space, the sort of the assessment of learning. But I think it's a much more vexed space. And that's because of the sort of cultural expectation that exists around the relationship between students and their teachers and assessment. There is and has always been an expectation that the teachers are the people who do the assessing. And so if we were to outsource that, so to speak, to a generative AI platform, from the community perspective of whether it would pass the pub test or what, you know, what people would think about that, it would be quite a challenge. I think there'd be a long conversation to be had around why that might be a decent alternative. Because people, I think, would see it as cost-cutting or as short-cutting. Lazy academics can't be bothered to do their own marking and get a platform to do for them. But there are actually lots of really good, valid reasons why generative AI platforms might do a better job. They might do it more quickly. They might do it more consistently and fairly. And we sort of assume, I mean, assessors, academics are humans. We assume that the same academic will always assess the same thing in exactly the same way. And we've developed ways of making sure that there's at least consistency about it. We develop rubrics so that when I assess something, I'm assessing this, that, and the other. But if you were to give me the same piece of work that I had assessed a year ago with the same rubric, can I guarantee that I would give it exactly the same score? No, probably not. There would be variability. So I think the promise of the generative AI platforms is that they can be absolutely consistent. They will always do something in exactly the same way.
I'm interested in your last question, the value of a degree in the post-gen AI world. I have no answer to it. Part of me is thinking that we'll get gen AI to do all the hard work so we've got increased leisure time or something like this. If we were looking at a situation like, is it important for me as a historian or a graduate of history to know the history of Venice? My suggestion would be not at all. It's widely available. What would be important for you?
How dare you?
Excellent histories are available and poor histories
are
available.
Do I need to know about the history of Venice? No, not at all. That has to go in.
Because it's widely available. It's not knowledge as such. The generation of knowledge would be me as a student graduating from a history degree, I don't know why I landed on history, and having the capacity for critical thought and critical engagement and evaluative judgment to determine without perhaps knowing the history of Venice, has this been constructed in a way which appears to be historically reliable and valid? So you know, the dates themselves, and I'm giving a very simplistic understanding of history, but the dates themselves are not important. The events themselves are.
Well, I mean, no, the dates are important because
they're not important for me to remember.
Well, they are and they aren't. The dates are important because we need to be able to relate them to other events in the world before and after. So they are hugely important as anchoring points.
But it's all available now. In a sense, there might be small disputes. I just need to use generative AI to bring it up.
So then my question for you, John, is, you know,
don't ask me any questions. I'm asking the questions here.
All right, the question I'll ask myself is...
Yeah, that's much better.
Thinking about what gets lost, people often talk about this idea of cognitive offloading, getting the generative AI to do the hard work of thinking. And make no mistake, we all know thinking is hard work. But the problem is, as institutions, we're in the business of teaching students to think. So if we come back to your question about, you know, what is the value of the value of the degree will depend on how effectively we are succeeding in that role of teaching students to think. And so that's all about our assessment design. I think those assessment designs will include use of generative AI because it's frankly going to be irresponsible to release students into a world that is rife with generative AI, being naive to what it does, how to use it, what its capabilities are, and what they should know about it. So I guess one of the things that I wonder about is how do we prevent that from happening? We know these students are trying to use generative AI tools to speed up the process, so they're avoiding some of the hard work of thinking. Now, how do we design assessments that force them to do some of that hard work of thinking? Or if in a few
years...
that's
the question.
Yeah, if in a few years we realize that something's getting lost, okay? The development of that critical thinking knowledge, et cetera. What if we decided, okay, something is getting lost. The foundational year of your studies has to be AI-free because you have to develop some of those foundational skills without any of this. How would we actually enforce that? How would we actually do that in a world where it's just impossible to control that?
To some extent, the question you're asking, it seems to me about with original thought and so forth, is what's the difference between how generative AI operates and the human mind operates? And at some point, generative AI, with this extraordinary power to just, you know, to sort of churn all the data it's been trained on, is extremely unlikely to come up with a new metaphor for a human experience, whereas humanity and humans would appear in the arts particularly to be capable of that, both standing on the shoulders of giants, I think is the expression. So, you know, drawing on the work that we've done, the research we've done, the learning we've done, but also then those moments where they produce original works. And I, to some extent, I think with your cognitive offloading, what may be missed in all this is the frustrations of scholarship, the confusions of scholarship. As my supervisor, Professor Tim McNamara, would always say, getting on top of the mess of data that's there and doubting every second week what you're doing. What happens if you remove all those from the equation?
Eric, one of the producers of this podcast, is in the studio with us today. Eric, what funny voice do you have for us for this podcast?
Hi, John. Well, this is my voice. What do you think? For the last couple of episodes, we've been playing with voice cloning, one of the many technologies that generative AI is making a real impact on. So just briefly, my voice here is a product of speech-to-speech technology. These are my real words and my real intonation, but the voice is completely different and is based on a clone trained using Gen AI. And for those interested, there are a number of new voice cloning products out there as part of the Gen AI wave. The one we're using here is from a company called 11 Labs, which is considered one of the best in class, at least for now. Anyway, let's take a break from our main topic for a moment and have a play with a relatively recent technology that's been garnering quite a bit of attention. It's a Google product called Notebook LM, and you can use it for free, for now anyway, if you have a basic Google account. What it does is allow you to upload documents and interact with them via a chatbot. So it's not alone in doing, say, good summaries of documents or the creation of lesson plans or FAQs. What sets it apart is the ability, with just a click, to create a podcast. And a very realistic-sounding podcast, I might add. And so what I did was take the transcript of your conversation with Raoul and Julian in this very podcast episode and made a new podcast using Notebook LM. And without saying much more, I'd like to just play you an excerpt and get your reaction. Okay?
Okay.
Sure, I'm all ears.
And in case I need to remind you, everything you'll hear here is a product of generative AI. Okay? Here goes.
Ever get that feeling? Like the ground's kind of shifting under your feet?
Mm-hmm.
That's what today's deep dive is all about. One of those seismic shifts.
Right.
AI crashing headfirst into education.
Yeah.
And specifically, how do we really know if a student's learned anything? If AI is writing their essays for them?
Oh, it is the question, isn't it? The one that's keeping educators up at night.
Yeah.
Look, students are at university to learn. That's the whole point.
Right.
But how do we measure that learning accurately when tools like ChatGPT could be, well, masking a lack of understanding?
It's almost like we've stumbled into this weird game and no one knows the rules.
Right.
And we're all trying to figure them out while the game's being played.
It's that rapid adoption, I think, that's both fascinating and unnerving.
Totally.
Universities are like scrambling to update policies.
Oh, I bet.
And you've got instructors feeling caught between, you know, the world they knew and whatever this is.
Totally. And right at the heart of it is assessment.
Absolutely.
Right. If an AI can spit out a perfect essay on, like, Venetian trade routes in seconds?
Right.
What's to stop a student from just hitting print?
Exactly. And that's where things get really interesting.
Okay. I'm intrigued.
So we were digging into this episode of the Secret Life of Language podcast.
Oh, I love that one.
And these two professors are going at it, debating this very issue.
No way.
One argues, full stop, back to oral exams.
Oh.
In a tech-free environment.
Seriously.
Dead serious. Mm-hmm. His thinking is it's the only way to be 100% sure it's the student's own work.
I can just picture it. Rows of students sweating over their Latin declensions. No Google Translate in sight.
Right.
It's charmingly retro.
It's amazing. I reckon, I mean, it sounds like American avatars of the two of us. You know, I'm the male and you're the female. It's that kind of interaction, but it's a lot smoother and broadcast trained, obviously, but it's pretty clever. And that was generated with a prompt and a press of a button.
Wow, it's amazing. But I do have a weird feeling that both of them are being too engaging in the interaction. So they've been trying too hard. Maybe it's a personal difference. For example, in the conversation, they might want to listen. And then once the person finishes the whole sentence, then you say something. But I guess it's AI pretending too hard to be a human being. So that's my impression.
Well, no, I'm much more convinced. It sounds to me like they've clearly taken two Hollywood professionals. I mean, I recognize that style of West Coast broadcasting voice. Very, very clear. Couldn't be from anywhere else in the world. Those people hope, you know, I hope they're well paid for what they've done, or they're getting some kind of residual.
Hmm.
Look, I agree with you about how the conversation feels like they're trying a bit hard. It's sort of like they're getting in each other's way a little bit, not giving each other enough space. And yet, it is a kind of a style, as John mentioned, that you hear, especially on chatty sorts of podcasts or on morning talk radio.
Yeah, I feel like it varies from culture to culture.
Yeah.
So, for example, the kind of podcast and audio voice I'm used to, so people would normally let the other person finish to show the respect, and then it's a polite way to let other people finish, and then you give comment on that. So it might depend on my own past experience and everything.
And so what you're waiting for is a longer pause between the two speakers. And if you're in Finland, that's certainly something you would expect. In Italy, that pause is zero overlapping because you can't have any silence at all. But the timing in these two voices is perfect for us. So there's never any let up, but it's not forcing us. It's actually perfectly timed here.
Yeah, we've just heard only an excerpt from this podcast of a podcast. But, you know, to my mind, it's really touching on quite a few of the relevant points there.
Oh, totally. I mean, it's really quite intriguing because you don't quite know how through a prompt, how it gets to cover all of those points to show that it has knowledge in the on the topic, but also to keep you interested.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, have you customized anything, for example, the voice?
No, so that's a good question. You have no control over the voices at all or the accents.
Okay.
It must be those two, the man and the woman, always having this conversation in that sort of style. I expect in the future you'll be able to change that. But just recently, in mid-October 2024, they added a customize button so that you can add a text prompt to direct the focus of the generated content. Before, you couldn't even do that. So here it's basing a lot of its conversation on the transcript of our conversation with Raoul and Julian that I uploaded into the chatbot as a PDF. You'll recall the idea of retrieval augmented generation, which we spoke about in previous episodes, where the LLM is able to direct its attention to sources that are external to its own pre-trained model. Well, that's what's happening here.
Mm.
And that's why we noticed the reference to Venetian trade routes and all that, which was brought up by you.
By me, not by you.
Yeah.
No, that's very clever.
Just one other thing. In terms of the examples, the reference to Venice came from the original discussion, but the reference to Latin declensions did not.
No, no. And how long did the process take from the moment you press the button?
It usually takes about maybe 3 minutes to generate. It just starts spinning and generates and comes back and you can just play it or download it. And just so you know, that was about a little under 2 minutes of the original, which was 11 minutes. Typically gives you about a 10-minute plus or minus podcast, and oftentimes with varying results. I've played with it quite a lot. Sometimes I'm really impressed with how well it's covered the topics. Other times they steer a bit off topic. I guess they hallucinate. It's kind of like, where did that come from?
Hmm. Pretty impressive nonetheless.
So, Raoul, you were saying that it'd be wrong for the students if they graduate from university without learning AI skills, right? And I guess it's still early days. I mean, there seems to be no consensus at any level of the university. So it's all a bit of a mixed bag about how much adoption there is. But looking a little into the future, shouldn't there be some sort of standard, maybe an accreditation even, around how institutions integrate AI technologies? And let's just use Australia as an example. If universities in Australia want to be nationally accredited, they have to meet certain standards. And my question is that, if we need to integrate AI into curriculum or into the learning process somehow, doesn't there have to be some sort of national overview?
The problem with standards is the difficulty of standards applying in a meaningful way to all sorts of different institutions, to all sorts of different courses and all sorts of different ways of learning. I think what the accreditation body will want to know is that universities have developed ways of meaningfully integrating AI into learning, but can demonstrate that they have confidence that students have done some of that learning, have learned how to think, and could not have got to the end point of their degree without having demonstrated genuine learning. Now, it comes back to that question we were discussing earlier about assessment and how you manage security. It probably involves thinking about assessment in a very programmatic way and saying, if we are imagining a student going through your degree, for example, we are not going to fret about whether or not every one of the assessments that they do are secure.
Right.
We are going to try and design meaningful assessments that tick off some of those boxes that we know are motivating for students. And then we're going to have a really good hard think about where are the checkpoints where I absolutely want to be confident that this student knows something. And at those points, I am going to invest in oral examinations or other ways of having conversations with students that will really convince me this student understands this stuff. I do think, as an aside, that generative AI, you know, we've talked a lot about the threats and a little bit about the opportunities, that there are lots of opportunities around that issue of examinations, for example. So if we start to think of generative AI platforms not as the sort of tutor that helps a student, but potentially as the examiner, and this challenge of scale, how would we do an oral examination for 2,000 students in first year biology? Then, you know, I can see a future that is not very far away where a generative AI examiner would talk to each student and say, here's my introductory question. I'm going to listen to what you have to say. Listening to your response, I'm now going to adaptively think of a follow-up question that explores some aspect of what you said, depending on whether you said this, that, or the other. And so the generative AI platform as interrogator, as examiner, as infinitely adaptable conversationalist that can go off in lots of different directions
so
can help.
We've got a solution. So we have resolved the solution of mass with oral exams. So, Raoul, thank you for that. Now, we can use oral exams as a means for assessment because we just use AI.
I think it's
AI.
Entirely possible that generative AI will be a friend in that space.
Yeah. Well, that winds up another episode of The Secret Life of Language. Special thanks to our guests, Professor Raoul Mulder from the University of Melbourne and Dr. Julian Harris from La Trobe University. Producers for this episode were Eric Van Bemmel and Kelvin Parham of ProFactual and Gavin Naber. The Secret Life of Language is recorded and mixed at the Horwood Recording Studios by Gavin Naber and is a podcast from the University of Melbourne School of Languages and Linguistics. This episode was produced with the assistance of Generative AI Technologies. Be sure to keep up with every episode of The Secret Life of Language by following us on the Apple Podcast app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. The Secret Life of Language is licensed under Creative Commons Copyright 2024, the University of Melbourne. I'm Professor John Hajek, and thank you for joining us.